Well, if you have a Bible with you, please turn with me to Revelation chapter 11. Now, we're not even going to do the whole part of the passage that George read earlier on. There is just so much here that is so wonderful, and which is also almost entirely incomprehensible at the first reading. So there's a little bit of unpacking to do as we go. And it is a tremendously powerful chapter. Many commentators identify it as one of the most difficult chapters in the whole of the Bible to interpret. But it's one of those chapters, and there have been others in Revelation and in Ecclesiastes that we're going through on Sunday evenings, where it looks most strange and odd at the beginning. And then with just a few keys, you can unlock it and the whole thing becomes so helpful and so relevant, and in this case also so powerful. We are still before the seventh trumpet has blown. Six trumpets have been blowing, six warnings, six kinds of events that happen between Christ's first and second coming, which give to this world a warning that a seventh trumpet will blow. They give to this world a warning that there will come a time when Jesus will return, and it will be too late then to decide, too late then to turn to him. Six kinds of things that happen in our world, the kinds of things that we can see on our TV screens, read of in our papers, things that we know are going on around us, which are sent by God to say to people, your life will not go on forever. You won't live forever. There will come an end. And whether that end comes sooner or later, you need to be ready for it. And so God in his grace, not in any malice, but in his grace, gives the warnings. Now, we have this sort of break in the narrative. We have this break in the way that John is seeing things unfold in chapters 10 and 11. It doesn't mean that the events here just come after six trumpets have blown, as if there are six kinds of warnings, and then all of a sudden all the warnings stop, and then we get the events in 10 and 11, and then we get the events from the seventh trumpet blowing from chapter 11, verse 15 onwards. It is that what goes on in chapters 10 and 11 is going on also in the same period of time, that together with the warnings come those who, as in today's section, those who will proclaim the truth about Jesus Christ. So as warnings go out into all the world, there are also those who are going to make sense of those warnings, who are going to be able to say, this means that we should do this. And that's going to be the gist of this chapter. Chapter 11, the first 14 verses, and if you do have it open, follow this with me just now. It has five sections to it. The first verses 1 and 2, the temple and the worshippers, that is the church protected. Which raises the question, protected from what? Well, that will come. Second part, verses 3 to 6. The two witnesses prophesying. That is the church's faithful witness. So the church is going to need protected because it's going to be a faithful witness. Third section, 7 through 10. Two witnesses killed. The church seemingly wiped out here and there. Oh, so we need protecting. Because being a witness is costly. Fourth section, 11 and 12. The two witnesses raised. The church lives on. It is not wiped out. And then verses 13 and 14. Judgment and grace. That there is salvation for those who will come to Jesus Christ. Now that's the sort of the plan of these 14 verses. We're not going to get through all those five sections that I just outlined this morning. I couldn't guarantee exactly how far we'll get. But we will certainly be looking at verses 1 and 2 and the gist of 3 through 6. The temple and the worshippers, that is the church protected. And the two witnesses prophesying, that is the church's faithful witness. Well, verses 1 and 2. I was given a reed like a measuring rod and was told, go and measure the temple of God and the altar and count the worshippers there. But exclude the outer court. Do not measure it, because it has been given to the Gentiles. And they will trample on the holy city for 42 months. Now, why is this called the church protected? The word protect isn't there, is it? Well, it's in the imagery. Remember, this is apocalyptic language. This is visions. This is symbols. This is things meaning something else. This is not necessarily to be envisaged, because the temple is also called a city. You remember that the temple there in verse 1 is also then the holy city in verse 2. So, you know, try and picture a temple that also becomes a city. It's one of those sort of dream things, those vision things, which shifts the more you look at it. Now, in this kind of visionary language, there are repeated in Revelation and in also other literature of this kind, there are repeated sets of symbolism, so that people who are reading this first century apocalyptic material, who would be familiar with the apocalyptic material in Ezekiel and Daniel in the Old Testament, for instance, and in other parts of the Old Testament, they would have the kind of vocabulary of imagery to hand. Now, we don't. And of course, one of the worst things that has happened to Revelation through the history of the church is that not having that kind of vocabulary of imagery, we've tried to make Revelation mean something which we can understand with our own particular imagery or timescales or whatever, as if the thing wasn't actually written to anybody in the first century. It was all, you know, it would be gobbledygook to them, and we've got to make it sound like something, you know, with a few calculators that makes some sense to us. But no, it was written for people in the first century, and they, with a wealth of this kind of literature, which we don't have, would have seen what it is. So part of the preacher's pleasure is to sort of provide some of this vocabulary for imagery. Temple. A temple which is also a city. The holy city. What is it a picture of? Well, it is a picture which in different places can mean a particular temple, but which often, and here in Revelation 11, verse 1, and the city in 2, means the place where God and his people meet. It is the place of fellowship with God. It is the place where God's covenant people are gathered together to him. And as we have in this verse here, the differentiation between the temple and then the outer court, a clear dividing line is being drawn between those who belong to God and those who have refused God. Those who have worshipped Jesus Christ and those who reject Jesus Christ. And here it's put in terms of the architecture of the temple and its precincts. There is the outer court, or the court of the Gentiles, as it would have been in the physical temple in Jerusalem. Exclude those in the outer court. Count. And here we are described as the worshippers in the main part of the temple. Now, that main part of the temple was bounded by a wall. The outer courts were as well. But that main part of the temple was bounded by a high wall. And what John is given this reed to go and measure is the extent of that protective barrier. Not just a defining barrier, but a protective barrier. Now, two things. Notice, first of all, that Revelation here and in many other places paints a black and white picture. Paints a black and white picture. You're either in or you're out. Now, there's something about our mindset these days which just doesn't like that sort of thing. We like shades of grey. And in many areas of life, there are shades of grey. Nobody would try and deny that. But in terms of our relationship with God, Revelation is making so clear at so many points, and definitely at this one, that there aren't shades of grey. As we put it once before, that there isn't actually an overcrowded fence, because there's no fence to sit on. You're either in or you're out. And that's not just kind of some kind of simplistic preacher's view. That's what Jesus said. Do you remember? He said, "He who is not for me is against me." That's complete polarization of humanity. Complete polarization of us here, sitting here this morning. You're either for or against him. It all hinges on your relationship with him. You're either in or you're out. You're either a worshipper or you rejected him. Now that division, that wall, if you like, is one that has a door in it. You can go from being one who's rejected him by accepting him to becoming a worshipper. You can be saved from what's going to happen to those on the outside and saved for what's going to happen to those on the inside. To put it at its most prosaic, you can become a Christian. Now, that's got to be one of the most unpopular kinds of ways of looking at things nowadays in our pluralistic society, in our tolerant society, in the way that we think about truth these days. It's the kind of thing that just sounds so bigoted. It sounds in the world just so dogmatic and really not very nice either. I mean, it's just not nice to say to people that you're on the outside, is it? I mean, exclusivism is what we're against, and we're all inclusive. Our language, our policies, our social practices, way schools are done. We've got to be inclusive. God is not that politically correct. And if it's all about how we stand in relation to Jesus Christ, then you can't be all inclusive. Because people do reject him and say no to him. The polarities, the stark black and white, in, out, for him, against him, Christian, non-Christian. The polarities that we read of in Revelation, they are real. They are real. And we become absurd if we try and pretend that they aren't. And it leaves us with a question, of course. And the question is, which side of the fence are we on? Well, there isn't a fence. Which, for or against? Jesus Christ. Not for or against the church. Not for or against the way Christian religion is done hither and thither. Not for and against virtue. For or against Jesus Christ, him, the person. A worshipper or a rejecter? Do you turn towards him, bow before him, yield your autonomy to him? Do you serve him? Or would you not yield your autonomy to anybody, thank you very much? And do you serve yourself? Do you bow before the gods of this world, of which there are so many? And those are the kind of categories that even the first two verses force us to come to terms with. And force us to come to terms with them now, right now, this morning, here. Not to put them off, but to come to terms with these two categories, in or out, right now. Well, the wall, the second thing about this wall, is that it is a place into which the Gentiles will come, but will come and trample. Now that sounds a strange thing, doesn't it? It sounds strange to say that the wall is about protection, that mention of the temple being measured, we know that it's this long and this wide, is anything to do with protection. What it means is that not one of God's people will be left on the outside. Here are the walls, here are the boundaries. No one will be left on the outside. Ah, but we read at the end of verse 2 that those who are on the outside, the Gentiles, will trample on the holy city. You know, the imagery just sort of shifts as you look at it. It becomes a city. They will trample on the city. And they'll do so for 42 months. We'll come to that in a moment. Well, here's the other thing, you see. John isn't just given an instruction to go and measure, to say, yes, there will be none left on the outside. He's given the instruction to count the worshippers. And if the first thing the measuring of the temple says that none will be left on the outside, where one day judgment will come and fall, the counting says not one will be missing. Not one will be missing. He knows the number. God knows them. We don't know the number. God knows the number of those who are on the inside. And the act of counting is to say not one will be missing. Remember, was it John Hanrahan in the Falkland conflict, standing there on the aircraft carrier and uttered those famous words, I counted them all out and I counted them all back. Not one missing. It's an expression of safety. They were all safe. They were all flew back in safely. They're all alive. Just exactly that kind of thing is being indicated here, which means that though the Gentiles trample in the holy city for 42 months, and though that even costs some believers, worshippers, their physical lives, not one will be missing. Though they take our, what is it that Martin Luther wrote? And though they take our life, goods, honor, children, wife, yet is their profit small, these things shall vanish all, the city of God remaineth. Yes, they can kill the body, but they can't take you out of the holy city. Not one will be missing. So those 50 or so Christians whose bodies were found in northern Nigeria, after all the hoo-ha over the Miss World contest, after the backlash against Christians that occurred there, oh, and yes, they were counted, and the photographs were taken. Those Christians in the Moluccas who have been killed because they were Christians, not missing, not missing. So the church, God is saying to John, by means of the symbolism in this vision, the church is ultimately safe. But not necessarily comfortable. The worshippers, we read the end of verse 2, will trample on the holy city for 42 months by those who are on the outside. The trampling, first of all, it's a piece of Bible imagery that we find in the Old Testament and also in the New Testament. The Greek word patio just means to tread on, to step on. It has to do with walking. If you're a music teacher who teaches an instrument around several schools, what are you called? You're called a peripatetic teacher. People try and say peripatetic, and it come out all wrong. It makes it sound like you've had just a little too much the night before or that morning or something, and it can come out horribly wrong, or you can't move any of your limbs, but it's supposed to come out like peripatetic. And it comes from the Greek verb peripatio, which means to walk around. So a peripatetic teacher is one who goes around. They don't walk. There wasn't a Greek verb for driving your car from school to school, but it comes. That's the idea. Now, the patio bit is the treading on. And we have a Latin version of that word and that verb when we have our patios, where we it's a Greek verb for where you put your barbecue. We get the idea. Now, the verb patio had a distinctive use. I mean, it had several uses, but there was one thing that it was always used for. It was always used for trampling out the grapes. So you get the slaves in your estate, put all the grapes into the wine presses out in the field, and they would just walk around on the inside and trample the grapes. Some of us would exert more pressure upon a grape than others, but we'd all get the juice out, walking around, trampling. Now, it has a particular power and significance in Revelation. He's evoking something here as God shows this vision to John and says they will trample on the holy city for 42 months. In the trampling, he's picking up on something from the Old Testament, from Daniel 7. Don't turn it up with me unless you really want to. But Daniel, of course you can if you want, goodness me. Daniel 7, verse 7, and then verses 24 to 25. This is what we read there. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled them underfoot. Trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. The 10 horns are 10 kings who will come from this kingdom. After them, another king will arise, different from all the earlier ones. He will subdue 3 kings. He will speak against the Most High and oppress his saints and try to change the set times and laws. The saints will be handed over to him for a time, times, and half a time. And in this apocalyptic language, a time is a year. A time, 1 year. Times, 2 more. And half a time. 3.5 years. You take a 30-day month, and 3.5 years becomes 42 months, becomes 1,260 days. They will trample on the holy city for 42 months. What John is describing here is what Daniel had described in his vision. Jesus spoke about the trampling. Luke 21:24. They will fall by the sword and will be taken as prisoners to all the nations, his people. Jerusalem will be trampled on by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles, the years of the Gentiles, are fulfilled. And Jesus was describing what John sees here. And then, as we have it in 11:2, the Gentiles will trample on the holy city for 42 months. Now, we're going to see later on that payback day will come. That those who have trampled will themselves be trampled upon. That what they have done will be done to them. Okay. Which doesn't sound all that unfair, does it? And so we have in the Old Testament in Joel chapter 3, 12 following, God trampling out the grapes, for the winepress is full and the vats overflow, so great is their wickedness. And then in Revelation chapter 14, 18 following, we have the trampling of the winepress outside the city. So they get in for 42 months, trample, that is, squash, persecute, tread on the church, but then there'll be a time when they're back outside and they won't ever get in again, and folk will get what they've done to God's people. And then in Revelation 19 about the Christ, the great victor in battle, treading the winepress of the fury of the wrath of the God Almighty. But for 42 months, the church will be trampled. The worshippers will be trampled. Now, 42 months, 1,260 days, as it is in verse 3, 3.5 years, or a time, 2 times, half a time, as it is in Daniel and it is elsewhere in Revelation. What does it mean? Well, as with almost all the numbers in Revelation, it does not mean 3.5 years. This might sound strange, but it doesn't mean 3.5 years. It doesn't actually mean 42 months over against 43 or 41 and a half. It doesn't mean 1,260 days over against, you can count them off on your calendar, over against 1,259 or 61. The numbers, like the images, like the colors, like the beings, have a symbolic value. Now, what's the symbolism behind 3.5 years? 1,260 days, 42 months. What's it saying? 2 things. first. And this would be just absolute commonplace in the first century. Folk would just know that this is what it meant, because it was part of the apocalyptic vocabulary and imagery. We don't, so it needs a little bit of teasing out. What does it mean? These two things. First, 3.5. Here's a bit of maths. 3.5 is half of 7. Good. 3.5 is half of 7. 7 is the number of God's perfection, of God's completion of his work, of the completion and perfection of all that the divine does. 3.5 as half as that is a number that says that God's going to get everything perfect, but we aren't there yet. His purposes have already been made known. Jesus Christ has already done everything that needs to be done. It is finished, he cried from the cross. There's the already, but we live in the not yet. We live in the time when that is yet to come. Perfection has already been accomplished, but we do not yet enjoy it. The church does not yet enjoy it. Not until Christ has come. And all the events surrounding that have taken place, will the perfection that is described in Revelation 21 and 22, when more measuring is done of the temple, but this time it's a golden rod that John is given, because it's a perfect measuring, everything is made perfect. That will come, but for now, it's not yet. So we have this halving of the number of perfection. To say, don't give up hope. To say, these times of persecution do not spell the end. To say, remember that this is the not yet, and the already awaits you. And the second thing about the 3.5 years has a particular reference to persecution itself. We sometimes have numbers which work as sort of codes. That if somebody says, if I were to say to you, 9 months, right? Then all of the women in the congregation would immediately know exactly what I'm talking about. All the blokes would take a little while to work it out. But 9 months, if someone was to say it's going to happen in 9 months' time, then what am I talking about? I'm talking about the time before the baby is born. Now, it's probably not going to be exactly 9 months. And it doesn't matter how many times they go around the wheel and try and work it out and everything else, the baby's going to come when the baby's ready. The baby might need, in fact, a bit of encouragement after a fortnight in Aberdeen. 9 months. Now, it's not the number of days, but you know what it means. 9 months means get ready for the baby born. 9 months means your whole life is about to change completely. 9 months in which to get as much sleep as you can, because you're going to get very little later. 9 months to suss out just how much stuff you have to take to go out of the house, even to town, to shop. 9 months to enjoy being able to leave the house within 30 seconds of having decided you're going to. 9 months, it means get ready. You see, the number has a significance way beyond it, just as a number. Now, 3.5 years, 42 months, 1,260 days, what would that mean to the first century church? What would that mean to those who knew what had happened in Jerusalem? Almost within living memory of 2 generations. 3.5 years was the time when Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus the Fourth, Antiochus Epiphanes, the most tyrannical and fierce Seleucid king, tyrannized and terrified Jerusalem, the Jews, in reaction to the Maccabean revolt. It was a time when the blood of Jews ran thick on the streets of Jerusalem, when the temple was desecrated. It was a time of the most horrific persecution.
3.5 years means... It doesn't mean 3.5 years. It means awful tribulation, awful trouble, awful trampling, awful persecution, pain, loss, death. It's a way of saying that the church will suffer in the way that the Jews suffered then in Jerusalem. The church will suffer in the way that there have been more Christians persecuted in the history of the church. For instance, we can draw a parallel, than were killed in the ovens in the Holocaust, and Jews were killed in the ovens in the Holocaust. It's that kind of thing. That kind of parallel is being drawn.
Now, we'll come back to more of what will happen to the church in this period that we read of in the first 6 verses. Suffice to say now, because as time is passing, suffice to say now that when the imagery picks upon the worst experiences of the worshippers of God in the place that was the holy city, when the imagery picks up on the time of the desecration of the temple by Antiochus Epiphanes, who set up his gods and his images there, the abomination that brings desecration. When the imagery picks up on that, then God also wants to say, and wants John to tell the churches, that it doesn't matter how bad it's going to get, you will be safe. The cost of being a lampstand may be what the world would call ultimate, may be what the world would think of as being too much to pay, but the cost of being a lampstand is not ultimate. Safe, safe, forever with God. Not one missing. And that is so because in the temple and there at the altar is the Lamb who was slain, who endured the death, who himself cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Who was trampled underfoot? Who endured the ultimate? So that we don't have to. Who drew the sting of death? Who descended into hell? So that we don't have to. So that now in him, we are safe. Are you in him? Amen.